The Guardian.
The Guardian Book Club with John Mullen, sponsored by David Stowe Cheddar.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Book Club. I'm Claire Armistead, books editor of The Guardian and Observer. Our guest this month is the Booker-winning Irish author Anne Enright. And as John Mullen explained, normally we get an author to talk about their most famous book, which would of course have been her Booker winner, The Gathering. But this time we decided to concentrate instead on her most recent novel, The Forgotten Waltz, which is set against the financial crash that is still reverberating around our world. It's the background to the book, but not its subject, which is the repercussions of an office affair. As John pointed out, adultery is surprisingly common in the Irish novel. So he asked, which came first, the subject or the plot?
I've actually written about adultery over the years. Long before it should have been of any interest to me, like when I was a baby writer. And when I was putting together the Grant Book of the Irish Short Story a couple of years ago, I noticed how much adultery there is actually in people like William Trevor. There's a surprising amount of it, perhaps because there is no divorce in Ireland. I don't know. Anyway, I just think it's a really interesting and fun subject. I mean, there's a lot of fun to be had with adultery, and it also, I don't know, it asks a lot of questions about the essential and the non-essential. Betrayal is always interesting. Sexual betrayal, lots of fun. I mean, just actually fun, you know.
One of the reasons my teacher thought that adultery and the novel were, for much of their history, sort of inextricable was exactly that adultery was a sort of absolute no-no. That it was something which plunged everybody involved, including the people who were, if you like, the victims of it, into socially extreme and terrible situations, you know.
So. Yeah, it helps if the novel is a very social novel.
Yes.
Because marriage is a social institution as well as a personal contract. And so in the context of the place I was writing from, which was 2009 in Ireland, you think, well, yes, as the old order fades away, then people are faced with new choices. And all the things we fought our parents for, which is the right to do as we wanted to, the right to kind of sexual self-determination, then became problematic when you had the freedom to do exactly that. So it was a very good crux subject for society in transition. But also, I had been looking at boom writers because you're constantly hectored in Ireland. So why are you writing such miserable old books when you should be writing about Ireland now? And here we are back in the bog and everybody's dead and it's all awful. And why are you not writing about contemporary Ireland? So you think, well, what is it about a boom? I was looking at various types of fictional literary responses to the boom, and some of them, the more attractive ones, I thought, the interesting thing about, say, Richard Yates, if you look at the adultery novels post-war, in suburban novels and adultery novels, Updike and all the rest of it, kind of, Yates was very interesting to me because his characters were coming out of a war and into suburbia. So you could see where the beginning of that, what might be called a crisis of masculinity or a crisis of domesticity, started there. Anyway, I just thought it was a very good subject for a boom, on the grounds that no one could afford it in Ireland before 2001. and it seemed to be the right subject for the times.
It's funny you say Ireland now, because I think for an English reader, there's quite a sort of frisson about reading a novel by an Irish writer set in Ireland, which has people wearing Issey Miyake dresses and kind of working in IT. So we are used to, I think, that idea that if you're an Irish novelist, you've got a rich tradition of repression to sort of draw on, and novelists find that quite useful.
Yeah, repression is a fantastic part of the engine. You get a bit tired of the branding of a country. And yes, there are international brands here. There's a slight feeling that Irish writers write many different kinds of books, but the ones that are most successful are set in the past.
Mm. The striking thing about the reviews of The Forgotten Waltz, the ones I read anyway, they absolutely agreed about how much they liked the novel, But they really disagreed about why they did, and disagreed not in a sort of various way, but in an oppositional way. And this is kind of manoeuvring out to talk about the narrator. Next. There was a review in one newspaper, an intelligent, well-written review, which said the narrator, Gina, is a pathologically honest narrator. And there was and also very well-written and kind of clearly argued review in another newspaper, which said, oh, she's a brilliant narrator because she's completely blind to her own deceitfulness.
And it's seldom that a writer can say this. I really enjoyed the reviewing process for the book. People really took what we call a scunner to Gina.
A scunner.
Took exception to her in an angry way, this dreadful woman. So I just thought it was interesting the way the reviewers were helplessly, they were somehow magnetised to some morality or how they read the morality, how they personalised, how personal their response was to Gina. And that pleased me no end. I mean, I did want a character that people would have mixed feelings about. I wanted to disturb the more po-faced reviewers by giving them a character who is manifestly not someone they would like to be stuck beside on a train or would ever consider, you know, this romantic foolishness as a subject, you know, that they were somehow obliged to find this serious for half an hour at a time. So that was a lot of fun.
Can I read the first two sentences? If it hadn't been for the child, then none of this might have happened. But the fact that a child was involved made everything that much harder to forgive. Not that there is anything to forgive, of course.
No.
Yes. I know this is a bit crude of me, but it starts where you might expect traditionally a tale of adultery to start with a sense that the person who's done it, you know, has done something bad. And then as soon as she suggests that she might have done, in one of her rather typically colloquial sort of ways, she sort of shrugs it off. And that sort of double thing about her is...
Well, it's a bit like life, you know, in that there are stages in life when you say, well, it happens, you know? This happens. There's no point squawking about it. Gina is the type of person who realises what she's saying as she says it.
Yes.
And I'm very involved in the idea of our own stories being a kind of revelation to ourselves. That if you put that is what story is, that's the engine of narrative. You tell yourself something about your life in order to make it true. That's what stories are. It's how we make sense of ourselves. And Gina is trying to make sense of herself. Not very well, because, you know, she has an impulse that is both noble and ignoble at exactly the same time.
Sometimes she wants to tell us stuff. And sometimes she says, sort of, mind your own business, doesn't she?
When she says about Connor, I can't go into the details. Yeah. There's nothing worse than the details. I want the reader to be saying, hang on, excuse me. But she's not going to do Connor. It's actually probably too painful for her to do Connor, because it would mean that she would have to confront her actions with regards to Connor.
Now, one of the funny things about the novel, maybe one of the things that makes it sort of, it reminded me in this respect a bit of... it's a dusty comparison, I'm afraid, but of Moll Flanders, who exists so powerfully that all the other people seem to be... Some of them, you know, you think they must have stories too, but I'm certainly not going to find them out. And, there's Connor, there's the wife, Aileen.
Yeah. The weird thing is when people read Aileen as though she were as Gina describes her, when Gina fails to describe her on every... At every moment.
Yes.
I don't know. Does she work? You know, God, she has some job.
Yeah.
And then she says, oh, well, of course she is. She works in college administration. Right. The wife is somehow archetypal. So poor Aileen is not described as a person might be described. Someone said to me, and then that awful wife. And I said, oh, she's not awful. Gina thinks she's awful. Perfectly nice person going about her life.
You allow Gina to say sort of, you risk, I suppose, alienating a reader's sympathies by allowing Gina to say some gratuitously sort of unevidenced cruel things about her and just sort of trivial, you know, her middle-aged lipstick and
paralyzed.
You know, and her little sort of little bits of fat and her... Were you so much in Gina's part that you found that kind of easy to do, or were you calculating how far you could go to make her a a completely sort of pitiless observer of her.
No, I wasn't particularly calculating. I wasn't particularly tactical. Gina doesn't look at the body of her future lover. She looks at the body of his wife, that there is a rivalry between them. Whereas the sex object in the middle of it all goes splashing off pretty much unnoticed. You know, that the body they're fighting over isn't of any interest. I mean, that's kind of buried underneath that scene. I didn't make it too explicit. But she's looking at the body, and some people said, oh, she's so horrible about his wife's body. And she says so elegant and boyish in the nip. She's not entirely
she said,
mean.
Don't you say neat little body or something?
They're both neat.
Yes.
They're both neat. A very tidy house.
And Sean, I mean, you say he splashes off. I suppose one of the risks of the narrative method is that he, although he's there a lot, although he says things, and although you get lots of little things about him, you know, funny stuff about how he makes a big thing about what he eats, but that's because he doesn't really enjoy what, not really.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And about his watch and his tie and his suits and how, where he gets. I mean, in a way, I think as a reader, I felt, I wonder what he's really like.
There is a skittering away from describing him, which was, as it were, deliberate. And I still don't know whether I was right. There is a scene missing from this book, right? Which is the scene where we see exactly why. It's a scene where they are completely, happily in love, right? And you say, oh, that makes enormous sense, and it's enough. I mean, I'm not saying that I have written this scene and thrown it out. I circled the idea of this scene a lot during the writing of the book. It would have made the book more old-fashioned, made it more almost 19th century. And I can't even explain it properly why I thought it would be wrong to do that scene for the book. It would be wrong for us to have a complete grasp of this man. I'm just saying to you that I know it's missing. I'm sorry.
No.
It was wrong for the book. Isn't this wrong now to discuss the book I didn't write? But I suppose that's what you have when you have the writer. You say, why didn't you do this? And sometimes the writer must let down the defences and say, well, I don't know. That's a very interesting problem.
But she asks him, she says, oh, you've done this sort of thing before, have you? And he says, well, you know.
What do you think?
And then he tells her about the relationship he had with the woman at the office and things. But I suspect there's a suspicion in quite a lot of readers' minds, or an anxiety. Is he just a, you know, is he a worthy object of
the
her?
Idea that love is meant, right, is gorgeous. And it's and it's particularly nice when you're 15. But these people, like all people, blunder along. They fail to end this affair. I mean, they keep trying to. It's not as if they set out to fall in love and leave their partners and do all of that. They blunder along. They don't even know what it is that they are setting out to do. So there is a kind of gap, particularly in the second half, of this unexpected outcome that now there are new possibilities for a different love with a different set of rules. They've been playing different types, the one-night stand rule, right? They broke that. They broke the affair rule, and now they have the uncharted sort of white territory of the relationship rules, you know, or the whole many sequences of different rules ahead of them. But they didn't do it on purpose, and they might make a good go of it, you know?
I didn't really get it, I don't think. The use of these song titles, some of which I recognised instantly, but a lot of which I didn't as the chapter titles. Why did that matter, having these?
The songs are because music does love best. And love is foolish, and female love is certainly foolish. Foolishness of that is celebrated in popular music. So I threw in the songs.
And what about the title of the novel?
Yeah, somebody on the radio said that was The Forgotten Waltz by Franz Liszt, and I went, ooh, ooh. So I typed it out, sent it off to my editor to see what it would look like, you know, when it comes back on an email. Actually, it would be a good title for The Gathering. Somebody remembering a tune, and it has that kind of feel of a tune picked up and remembered again, which is perhaps in all my work. So putting things in order and reconstructing them and failing to reconstruct them and then trying again, then getting something maybe a little beautiful out of it after all. I just thought of it as a good way of showing the kind of stunned feeling to erotic love in particular and the amnesiac feeling, mm-hmm. how the space in the hotel rooms where they have their afternoon trysts is a sort of blank. And that this series of gestures that they make towards and away from each other is a kind of waltz, but that also is a kind of tranced event, you know?
And that sort of amnesia seems quite emphasised by booze as well.
Many people have picked up on the drinking as if it were some kind of Irish thing, and I was thinking, this is middle-class drinking, guys. So it's just socially accurate. It's the weekend, do you know?
But it's quite important to the plot, isn't it?
I also think that it's socially accurate that people don't necessarily run off for a one-night stand at a strange hotel in the middle of nowhere if they're not pissed,
yeah.
Do you know? I mean, it's just statistics, you know? So, I was really good all night and then I ended up in bed with this... Ooh, God, yeah. Doesn't happen. And she says, by Connor, that they went off to Australia and they discovered how to have sex sober,
yes.
Which was the new thing. really brilliant. But much to be recommended, you know. Whole other game. But we get no sexual description.
No.
As to what happens with herself and Sean.
I don't think there's any sexual description of any kind.
No, this is Mariella Frostrup's fault. She said to me, you know, there are more male members in the gathering than in a medical textbook. She sounded very disapproving. And then I went off thinking, what's wrong with that? What is wrong with that? Why do women not want that? That's because women don't talk that way. Women, when they're in love, they don't describe it physically. So I challenged myself to do a book where people were at it like knives every second Friday for years without having any physical description. And that was enormously good fun too. So much kissing, you know. Everybody knows this, but it took me a long time writing many books to realise it's much more effective to write about kissing.
One of the peculiar effects of the Forgotten Waltz is a lot of the time it is like she's talking rather than writing, as it were.
Yeah.
She uses lots of those funny little redundant phrases that you use in speech, but that you, if you're writing something, you shouldn't use. You know, of course, and
yeah.
I have to say, and if the truth be told.
They're really quite careful. I mean, this, yes. There's nothing abandoned about my little clauses,
yes.
There. They do indicate an anxiety, an unsettling in the sentence, you know, that if she says, of course, then you have to start disbelieving her. But her challenge is to break out of the solipsism of the first person voice, to see the situation she's in somehow from the outside, and that's where Evie comes in.
Yeah.
That it takes her three quarters of the way through the story to actually appreciate that this wretched child isn't just a wretched child, this creature who's in her way has a story, and to sort of give in to the child.
Yeah.
Give in to the humanity of this, you know, small human being. She doesn't really give in to any other person's humanity throughout the book.
What about her mother? I mean, her relation with her mother, but particularly the death of her mother, seems quite a visceral thing for her, in a way that her lover and her husband and others perhaps don't.
Mothers are a huge challenge. And the mother in the gathering is absent. I mean, that's how... So a lot of the rage in the gathering is a kind of infantile rage, the absence of the mother. This mother is one of those relationships when the mother and the daughter are friends, which they're on side, and they talk about clothes and they talk about and they're gossipy and they really get on. I don't know if that's how. I mean, I know what. I mean, there was lots going on there, and there's lots in the sympathy for the mother because the father was not a reliable character. But the fun was with the sister. Everything she says about the sister could be interpreted as a roar of jealousy.
Yeah.
She says, I walked down the street with my sister, who's the same weight she was when she was in high school. You know, a roar of jealousy. She hasn't put on a pound since she was 16. But jealousy and love are actually so side by side in her relationship with her sister. They're indistinguishable. And all of Gina's loves are jealous loves. And that's why the wife is so important as well.
There's a moment where Fiona suggests to Gina that actually Sean has shown an interest in her too.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, that's a total betrayal for her.
Yeah.
Yeah. Of course, because Fiona's got everything. She's pretty and she's actually a very nice person, Fiona. From a social satirical point of view, you put someone in a mobile home that costs 100,000 euros, you'd expect that character, from much talk about her silly heels and her handbags or whatever. But Fiona's just a person who's trying to make good and rear her children and, you know, she's typical of a lot of women I knew during the boom who were not particularly greedy or whatever.
We don't know whether what Fiona says about him is true, do we? I mean, whether it's not a kind of her riposte to her sisters.
No, we don't know. But we could make a good guess that it probably is true. It is a very pretty woman living, you know, 600 yards down the road.
So then it becomes more evidence of what we were talking about much earlier, which is that, is this guy Sean, is he the sort of, is he the person that Gina
yes.
thinks he is, or is he a philanderer, really?
Yes. Which is also an insecurity of, will he do it again?
Yes. Well, I suppose that is this.
Yeah. Yeah, so sure. Yeah, no, these are all... There is always a wake-up to the reality of love moment.
Continuing what you just said, I've been wondering how this book was received in Ireland.
The thing about Ireland is it has an amazing readership. And they're a silent readership. The American readership is really noisy, really bloggy, really full of opinions and recommendations and criticisms and everything. The Irish readership is entirely silent. When I wrote The Gathering, I'd go down to the school in the morning and I'd see a kind of look from someone. I'd say, oh, Jesus, what did I do to that woman? I'd say, oh, no, she's read the book. But no one would ever say it to you. They might say a little while later, oh, I read the book. Oh, I read your book, right? Then there are the critics and commentators who are involved in their own conversations and their own agendas, many of them to do with Ireland and Irishness and their own self-importance, and then we must ignore them at all costs, right? And this has always been the way in Ireland for Irish writers. The readers are there. I live near where Fiona lives in the book, and I went up to have a cup of coffee with my kids in the cafe the weekend after The Forgotten Waltz came out, and a woman passed by and she said, I read it. Loved it, she said. And I said, oh, brilliant. And I said, if I get her, who is like Fiona's next door neighbour, I'm done. Thank you. Good night.
The Guardian Book Club with John Mullen is sponsored by David Stowe Cheddar. Cornish cheddar is made with over 60 years of knowledge, time and skill. To find out more, please visit davidstowecheddar.co.uk.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.